the Nightlife Podcast.
Today marks 90 years since the ABC was born. We're going to start off chatting with someone who's seen a big chunk of that, been a big part of the history, Chris Masters.
Hello, I'm Chris Masters, and welcome to the third in our week-long series of programs celebrating...
Yeah, that's Chris Masters. He joined the ABC in 1966. You probably remember Chris as a long-term Four Corners investigative reporter. Many of his stories influenced Australian public life significantly during the 1980s, 90s and 2000s. Won a Gold Walkley for his 1985 Four Corners report, French Connections, about the infamous sinking of the Rainbow Warrior. Another of his famous Four Corners reports, The Moonlight State, 1987, led to the Fitzgerald inquiry into corruption in Queensland and arguably the demise of the Bjelke-Petersen government. He's the author of five books, including Uncommon Soldier and Jonestown, his 2006 biography of Alan Jones. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Chris Masters to Nightlife. G'day, Chris.
G'day, James.
Yeah, thanks very much for joining us. You came to journalism early in life. You started an ABC cadetship after you finished school. Why did you always want to become a journalist?
Well, I think I really started expecting I'd probably be something like a cameraman. My older brother went to the ABC as a cameraman, but my mum was a journalist, and, you know, it's media. It's pretty much the same thing. And as it turned out, I expected to get a job in the camera department, but after a little while there, a job came up in the bush. They called it in those days a talks officer. And I'm from the bush, so I was keen to go back, and that's pretty much how it began.
So where was that, and what was it like doing that?
Look, at the time, of course, I didn't realise what a fantastic grounding I was getting, and that's one of the great things about the ABC. You know, it's great to be remembered, and it's great to think that of those 90 years, you know, like half of those, that time I had a fantastic time at the ABC. You learn so much. And I was sent down to ABC Albury as this talks officer assistant to the regional manager was the actual designation. And I can remember sitting and turning up at a local motel and listening in, and terrified, of course, because I was doing radio in those days, and you know, this was my start. And I tuned in, and I heard the local news bulletin. It was actually read by Cleaver Bunton, who'd be remembered by some people because he was the mayor of Albury for something like 50 years. And I can still remember how it started. Here is the news for the Riverina in northeastern Victoria, prepared by Cleaver Bunton and read by Cleaver Bunton. Today, the mayor of Albury, Alderman Cleaver Bunton, said. So, you know, multi-skilling was the order of the day in those days.
I reckon when you learn on the job, you just kind of ingest it all. But if someone asks you what you've learned, it's hard to write down. And then maybe a few years later, you think, oh, all that stuff I was learning, there were actually some core principles there. So looking back on it, were there some core principles of good journalism you learnt in those early years?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think I really learned investigative journalism in places like Albury and Kempsey and Tamworth and Rockhampton doing the regional rounds, because you'd wake up in the morning and nothing happened, and you'd wake up the next day and nothing happened yet again. So you had to get out of the office, you had to dig, you had to respect every story. You couldn't be a snob about stories. You couldn't pick and choose. You really learned that it was your craft, your developing craft, that made the difference. I think the other thing about it, James, that was really important was it really calibrates the moral compass. You're living with the people you're reporting on, and you've got to be tough-minded. You know, people have wants and needs, and sometimes the stories you tell are not stories they're pleased with. But there's this constant skirmish going on. But the good thing about that is that they look you in the eye, and they'll see you at the bus stop, you know, and they'll take you on. Whereas I think you can be a bully in the media, you know, you can belt people up from a distance and never have to confront them face to face. So I think that helped me too, because it taught me the importance of being fair.
You mentioned story a couple of times, looking for stories as if, you know, almost as if the world's full of fully formed stories and you just got to go and find them. But really there's heaps of people walking around with things that you might see as a story that they don't, just a collection of experiences and facts that a journalist or a storyteller somehow fashions into a story.
Yes.
How do you go about thinking, well, that's a story, I think there is a story I can tell there, but actually over here, you know, that's not a story? Like, what's the test?
Well, Mum was great at this. You know, Mum worked in provincial newspapers and she saw a story in everything. She said the best story is in the human heart. You know, you don't need riots and conflict, bombs going off to be able to tell a story. Those stories tell themselves. I mean, we aren't the stories, we're the storyteller. And that's what was great about all that grounding the ABC gave me for all those years. I was learning storytelling. I wasn't necessarily great at it at the beginning. And in fact, I really don't think I had any natural talent in radio at all. But I had learned, I think, omnisciently, you know, growing up in that big family with a mother who was a journalist who couldn't, you know, she couldn't go to the corner shop without coming back with a story. And I think that served me well over time.
And you know, given it's the ABC's birthday, what was the ABC like in the 1960s? How was it similar? How was it different?
Well, I remember years ago talking to a bunch of young ABC journalists, and they were talking. They'd come out of you know, journalism school, and they just started, and they were talking about their colleagues in the commercial media, and they were saying that, you know, when we came home, we talked about the stories we did that day. You know, our commercial colleagues were talking about the politics of the workplace and, you know, who was getting the better clothing allowance and stuff like that. Even today, you know, when I watch young ABC reporters, particularly from the bush, stepping up, particularly, say, at a time of crisis, the floods and the fires, etc. I love the way they're so proud of what they do, and, of course, they get such positive feedback in the communities because they're doing a really important job.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sustainment and satisfaction in that.
Chris, how did you get from what did you say that weird title was, talking assistant or something?
Oh, I was a talks officer, assistant to the regional manager.
That's right. How did you get from talks officer, assistant to the regional manager to Four Corners?
Well, that's quite a story. I went from Albury and I ended up in Rockhampton. Rockhampton had a television station and, you know, this shows my age. It was black and white in those days, and it was my first experience of television. It was interesting, James, because I reckon I struggled in radio because I wasn't really a quick processor. You know, I didn't really fancy my opinions. And I don't know that, you know, maybe that it was that photographer in me. When I started telling stories with pictures, I was a lot better at it. It came as a bit of a surprise, actually.
Yeah.
And I was in the rural stream of the ABC, working for the rural department. There was a tragedy that brought me to Sydney. My daughter, my 3.5-year-old daughter, contracted cancer, and this is one of the worst things about, you know, living in regional rural Australia, that there just wasn't the medical facilities to look after her there. And so we had to come to Sydney and I had to get a job. Yeah. And because I had a connection to the rural department, I started doing some work on a big country and countrywide and programs like that. And I only did a couple of programs for Countrywide, and Four Corners saw me and picked me up. And that's quite a good story too. Jonathan Holmes, the name you would know, he was the executive producer of Four Corners at the time. So he's a Pommy. He's come out to Australia to run Four Corners from Panorama. And the first thing he didn't like about ABC reporting was that it was so Pommified. You know, all the reporters sounded very Oxbridge. And he said he started to look for somebody who was actually was grounded in Australia. And he saw this this ragged reporter from Countrywide, and they asked me to come and join Four Corners. It was kind of amazing. It was going from, you know, the fourth grade to first grade overnight.
Yeah, well, that must have been intimidating.
It was intimidating, but I the first story I ever did for Four Corners was the Big League, which, you know, was a real blockbuster of a report. And I think when I think back on it, it was like I didn't know what I couldn't do.
Yes.
You know? I think I was lucky that I came in from the regionals. I also came in with a lot of respect for Four Corners. You know, I can remember my mum, you know, religiously watching it, and you know, she took journalism seriously. I think she sort of gave me my sense of journalism as a vocation. So I didn't, every time I had an opportunity to do a story at Four Corners, I wanted to do my best. And this was an interesting story because you probably know my brother Roy. He was a rugby league coach at the time. And and so I had a bit of knowledge about the rugby league, and I said, why don't we do a story on rugby league? And they weren't used to hearing this sort of talk. They're used to doing stories about, you know, private schools versus public schools and stuff like that. And yeah. And anyway, I started doing a story on corruption in sport, essentially in rugby league, and that led to a story about corruption in the judiciary in New South Wales, which in turn led to the Street Royal Commission and the standing down of the Premier Neville Wran, and a huge amount of controversy.
So Chris, let me ask you this: you were talking about when you were working in the country, the importance of digging. So how did you dig out that story, given that everyone who was involved with it in any sort of unscrupulous way would obviously want to say nothing about it?
Yeah, well, the great thing about Four Corners, which continues to this day, is your capability to be persistent. Most journalism is rip shit and bust, as we put it. You know, the news cycle barely lasts 24 hours.
Yeah.
At Four Corners, you have an opportunity to dig and to go further, and you end up taking that pretty seriously because it is a rare opportunity, and that's the way it went. I mean, a story that began about corruption in sport, you know, whether rugby union players were secretly paid boot money and things like that. Just one step, two steps, three steps.
And what's the first step? Is the first step someone kind of telling you totally off the record, someone who's trust that you win that, yeah, this stuff is going on, and then the second step is trying to find a specific case and then someone who go on the record? Is that kind of how it works?
People often think that it's very Watergate-like, that it's driven by sources, that essentially somebody in a car park tells you something and you report on that, you know. But I don't think that. Of course, sources are really important. The telling moment is when you begin to figure it out yourself. You know, you've got this matrix of information. It probably starts with you going to the library, very important libraries, I have to say, and picking up the clippings file and then reading through the clippings file and then making these cold calls, talking to people, essentially you're saying to them, talk to me off the record, because you know that if it's controversial and sensitive, they probably won't want to go public. And then just if you're allowed to keep going, this is where you really need to hold your nerve, because I think if investigative journalism worked in a 48-hour time frame, you know, we'd see a hell of a lot more of it. But the fact is, you know, most people get an opportunity to spend 24, 48 hours on a story. Few people get the opportunity to spend weeks on it. And it really takes weeks before you begin to get that first break.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, James, how often, you know, you find that when you go to someone and you say, what's really going on? And they say, look, you know, I can tell you, but it has to be off the record because, you know, if I go public on this, I'll be ruined. Mm. Then you start to build a bit of evidence and then you go back to them. And often when they see that you really have been invested in it and you've built a story that's credible and probably going to be believable, that, you know, they come along.
Right, right. And what, do they come along because, you know, they're scared of not putting their view or because they think, look, the house of cards is falling in, I might as well, you know, I might as well fess up? Or what do you think motivates them to go on the record?
I think, you know, they're playing a part in history. They recognise, a lot of people, I've had this situation where they'll say to me, what's in it for me? And I'll say, well, you know, nothing much more than the opportunity to be a good citizen.
Yeah.
And some people will scoff at that, but other people will say, no, you know, I want, this has happened to me recently with the stories that I've been doing on the war crimes in Afghanistan. You know,
yep.
Witnesses have actually said to me, look, I want my grandkids to be proud of me. I know this is a moment where I really need to take a moral stand,
yep.
And I'm glad the opportunity to do it. Great thing about the ABC, great thing about Four Corners is that there's a damn good chance that they'll trust that you will join them in taking the risks and doing some honour to the position that they've taken.
Yeah, yeah. Can I play a clip from your Four Corners story, French Connections, which exposed the French Secret Service's bombing of the Greenpeace vessel, the Rainbow Warrior, the story in 1985.
Midwinter in Auckland Harbour. It is still and cool. There is a light mist and the tide is beginning to turn. A birthday party is underway on board the Rainbow Warrior. No one has any reason to look over the side, and if they did, they would see nothing. The diving apparatus being used is almost certainly sophisticated rebreather equipment, which leaves no telltale trace of bubbles. The two powerful explosive charges being laid are expertly placed. The target was not one of war, but of peace. This is not the Middle East. In fact, Auckland Harbour, in nuclear-free New Zealand, is about as far from a war zone as you can possibly get. It was such an unexpected crime, such an unlikely act of terrorism, it's still difficult to believe it really happened.
So that from my guest Chris Masters' Four Corners story from 1985, French Connections, which exposed the French Secret Service bombing of the Greenpeace vessel, the Rainbow Warrior. And Chris, before we go on, shout out to the sound editors there. There were some great soundscapes, wasn't there?
Yeah, terrific camera work too.
Well, we had to imagine that, but I must say I could almost see the pictures as I was.
Yeah,
I was. But that's an important part, I guess, isn't it, of immersing people in a story?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you. It was one of the great things too about resourcing a program like Four Corners. I mean, people all say these days that, well, why can't you just use your iPhone? You know, but yeah. iPhone might pick up a picture, but it won't pick up a sound, and particularly big sound on a big soundscape.
Yeah. So you didn't know, of course, who bombed the Rainbow Warrior when you started out the story. What made you want to get into it, and at what point did it become clear to you what the truth was?
It's a great story. I give a lot of credit to my executive producer at the time, Peter Manning. You know, he's somebody, there's this black art in journalism. If you hang around stories for a long time, you just get a bit of a sniff that there's something more to this one. And it was really his call, not mine. As a matter of fact, I took with me the clippings file of the New Zealand Economy because I thought, you know, I'll spend 2 or 3 days on trying to find out what happened and there won't be much in it, but I can't go to New Zealand and come back with nothing. So I'll be doing a story about the New Zealand Economy. Well, as it happened, you know, we did the classic sort of digging and shoe leather wearing out. And a turning point was after we literally found some great evidence on the ground, you know, the fact that a couple had been watching the harbour that night because there'd been pilferage of boats and they'd written down the number plate of a suspicious camper van.
Wow.
And someone else also did something else that also identified one of the French Secret Service agents' cars. So the police were onto that camper van, and there was a senior police officer who was running the inquiry. We called him Lockjaw because he wouldn't say anything.
Right.
And I went along to talk to him. And this is after we'd done a little bit of work. And I came to the view that the French Secret Service were likely to be behind this. And I said it to him. I said it to the police officer. And it was just the look on his face. And this is really telling because this is how journalism has to be practiced. You know, you have to be there. You wouldn't get that over the phone. You know, you wouldn't get it over the internet. But just the look on this police officer's face said to me, he thinks this too. And that gave me and my colleagues, Bruce Belsham and others, the confidence.
Again, with respect to the Rainbow Warrior, as you started getting nearer the truth and you realised there was a story and it was something that could go to air, did you start getting, like, thinking this is really going to blow things up and feel the pressure of that?
That was a rare one. I mean, a lot of investigative journalism you do is grim and miserable. You know, it's sort of war zones, it's you know, hanging on by your fingernails and maybe not getting there at the end of the day. This was like the Rainbow Warrior story was like being in the side of inside a international spy thriller. I mean, literally, you know, we chased the French bombers all over the world. And in France, it was like Watergate. It was such a big deal. But so I went from New Zealand to Tahiti. They sunk that beautiful little yacht, the Avea, because, you know, we got the yacht on the radio and said we wanted to meet the people as they berthed in Noumea. And, of course, that meant that they met a French submarine at sea and scuttled the Avea. Then, you know, we flew to Paris, and I had to sort of work really hard to develop some contacts in Paris who had connections into the French DGSE. And when I was in Paris, the story was just beginning to break. And word got out that the French may well have been behind the bombing in Auckland. And they knew about this Australian journalist who turned up, who seemed to know a little bit more than they did.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating. You know, I'd come back to my one-star hotel at night, and there'd be 20 or 30 journalists trying to buy me beers.
Right.
We got on a plane. Eventually, I got back to Australia, and the timing was perfect. I remember. The wonderful Andrew Olley introducing the program, at the very time that the French government announced that their inquiry into it had demonstrated that, you know, they had no involvement whatsoever.
Right.
And of course, the program comprehensively demonstrated the opposite. It was one of those rare occasions where I might have done something for the balance of payments, because it's very unusual, James, for a story in Australia to be of interest right across the globe. It was of interest in everywhere, except I don't think the French wanted to buy it for some reason.
Yeah, yes, I bet. Can we go now to the Moonlight State? I reckon this is your most famous story. It was the one that first sprang to mind when I was thinking of you. 1987. Here's a clip from it, the Moonlight State.
In the Sunshine State, sex is a great little earner. There's a plentiful supply of fresh and eager clients. So in free enterprise Queensland, there should be plenty of room for small business to capitalise on this market thrust. This man was one of the profiteers, peddling male prostitution and pornography.
When you walk in this sex shop and it's wall-to-wall hardcore pornography and also X-rated movies, which are also illegal in other states, but in Queensland, not a problem. Walk in the door, baby, a wall-to-wall sex.
This man also sold sex for the same group of people, a group he called the Syndicate.
You've got to understand that the Syndicate's not too interested in letting too many foreigners in, because while there's only four, there's a gold mine. If there was 40, there'd be a bit of silver, that's about it. And that's the way they work. And at the moment, they've got it sewn up, and the police are happy.
And this man's job was supposedly to catch the members of the so-called syndicate.
They weren't touched. I suppose in some ways, I have to look back on that and say that I can't say whether they were untouchable, because nobody ever tried to touch them. I think in many ways that it would have been stopped if we'd have tried to go after them. But it was just never considered.
One of the interesting things about doing a retrospective like this, Chris, is that each of those three unnamed men sounded young enough to possibly be listening tonight. That'd be weird,
well,
wouldn't it?
I'm in touch at least with one of them. So, yeah, I think it would be.
Oh, really? Okay. So it started with a focus with a report on Queensland's sex industry, but it went right to the top of power in Queensland. How early did you know that's where it might be heading?
The reason to start the story in the first place was because of this cri de coeur from a police officer that I spoke to. He didn't really want to go public, but he told me a story of being bribed by a superior, and how it was a crime against his conscience to take the money, you know, and he didn't know what to do. Mm. He knew that if he crossed his superior, they wouldn't trust him, and it would be a crime against his career. To take the money was a crime against his conscience. And I mean, you know, that got to me. I thought this is just outrageous. It gave me the moral impetus to push on, and of course it also gave me a sense that this was systemic corruption. Over time, you know, I came to see that there was an architecture to the Queensland police corruption that probably was quite common across Australia in preceding decades.
Yeah.
Corruption had metastasized in the other states so that it became like a can of worms, you know, individual pockets. But in Queensland, it was quite systemic, and it was like a pyramid. It went to the top, to the commissioner, Terry Lewis. And we got a good sense of that. But for all that, it was a demoralizing experience. You know, I was talking to people who were in the brothel industry, in the drugs industry, gambling, disgruntled cops. I used to joke that I was looking forward to meeting a gruntled one. So I didn't really think, James, that it was necessarily going to go anywhere, because people had a go at Queensland corruption before. We powered on, and looking back on it as I now can do, I can see that there were some things playing my way that I didn't know at the time. You know, that was that Joe Bjelke-Petersen was beginning to be on the nose. even within his own party, you know, there'd been the Joe for Queensland tilt, Joe for Canberra tilt, yeah, and the business community in Queensland were also sick of him, because corruption is not just bad for moral reasons, it's bad for practical reasons as well. You know, it means that the bad guys win.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Queensland, they were getting well and truly sick of this. So when eventually we did, you know, these things aren't going to work if you haven't got the evidence. And the crucial evidence was discovered. That is, we were able to make a link between the criminal syndicate, as was described earlier, and the police hierarchy. As soon as that happened and they knew that we were onto that, they were really onto us and made my life miserable and, you know, smashed our camera in the streets of Fortitude Valley. When we went to air, it was a compelling program, you know, and I think it wasn't just the fact that we had the evidence. I think it was also because the story was told in a way that made the Queenslanders care about it. Mm. You know, I hope that doesn't sound corny, but I think in a way, you know, if you were a visiting fireman, if you came up from Sydney and you told a story about, you know, the hillbilly dictator, you know, you tended to get run out of town. In this case, I think people could see that there was real substance to it, and I'm proud of the way that that Queensland responded. There was a Fitzgerald inquiry, you know, it uncovered quite a great deal, and more so, it also exported the talent that we saw in Queensland around the nation. You know, the Wood Royal Commission in New South Wales followed the Fitzgerald inquiry, pretty much staffed by the same people.
Here's another clip from Chris Masters' 1987 report into corruption in Queensland, and this bit about police corruption, the Moonlight State.
In the last month, I've spoken to a young policewoman who says that on the walls of the station they write NRMA, nothing really matters anymore. I've spoken to a detective constable who insists that 99% of police are totally honest, and near to tears tries to explain to me that the problem is they simply can't rock the boat.
Nigel Powell also worked in the Valley as a plainclothes detective constable in the licensing branch. He later became a police prosecutor.
I mean, theoretically, they were touchable. Theoretically, we could have gone out there and gained evidence. Given resources and given time, I've no doubt that we could have gained sufficient evidence to prosecute all the principals.
I've spoken to a detective sergeant who says that to survive in this place, you have to discover neutral territory where you see no evil and hear no evil, particularly if it's evil within. And I guess the final word should go to a retired senior policeman who says, "What's the point? I spent my whole career bashing my head against a brick wall. It made no difference. The public really don't care anyway. And in the end, the crooks win."
That's Chris Masters from the Moonlight State, his 1987 expose on Four Corners of corruption generally and partially in the police force in Queensland. Chris, you've said this story almost killed you. You've spoken about the pressures of it. I remember just randomly getting into a lift with you one day about 20 years ago in the ABC and asking you how you were going. I think we'd, you know, met vaguely at one point before then. And you just seem to have the weight of the world on your shoulders, probably doing some other story. How do you deal with all that pressure?
Well, you know, as best I can.
Yeah.
I think the thing about it is that my mother used to say, essential in journalism is to finish what you start. And that's been my attitude. And so I'm still being sued right now, and I think it's kind of crazy that someone at my age has been sued all my life. But I finish what I start. I've just got to get on with it. When it got absolutely burdensome, which was the case with the Moonlight State, I called it, you know, my death by a thousand courts. You know, it was a profoundly important piece of journalism, but it goes to show how tough the defamation laws are, that such a understood valuable piece of journalism could be almost the most punished journalism ever. You know, it was like 13 years in court and a range of trials before we eventually won it. It took a huge amount out of me, and I think it's probably also true, James, if you are at the cusp of a significant reform, it's not a pretty place to be. You tend to get punished. There was a whole lot of people who lost out in Queensland because of the changes that occurred, and of course they were going to hate me and my ilk forever. You know, people like Tony Fitzgerald, who ran that inquiry, I don't think it puts a smile on his face either. But for all that, you know, it was clearly valuable and important.
It was. And if you think, okay, this is important and I want to keep doing it, do you have to find ways of looking after your own mental health and physical health, I guess?
I used to say at the time that I had to sort of treat it like I had a disability, that I had to get on with life. There was no point in complaining about it. I realized that I was becoming an enemy to myself because, you know, people would ask you, like you did in the lift, how I was going. And it would seem like I needed treatment, because you become obsessive and you start to rant, you know. You feel very, very lonely. I don't know. I was probably enormously helped by my family and people around me, but I think you also haven't got much choice, you know.
Yeah.
You've just got to keep going. And in the case of the Moonlight State, it was important for our industry, it was important for journalism that we win that one, because if we lost it, you know, if you lose a case as important as that, then what's the future of investigative journalism?
Chris, you know, going from to something even tougher, really, if there is anything tougher than the Fitzgerald Commission and the Moonlight State war reporting, have there been times when you've been reporting in war zones where you've been really scared?
Yes, I mean, I used to say that we're lucky in Australia. I mean, very few journalists have been killed in the line of duty in Australia, but you're reporting in a war zone, and a rogue helicopter comes past and you know, blasts the hell out of the hillside. You know, you're gone, and you know, there's almost nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
A road bomb or something like that. And I wouldn't want to overstate it either. I mean, you know, I was well protected, well looked after. A lot of the war reporting I did, I was surrounded by soldiers who were taking a lot more risks than I did. But I still can't really work it out, in the sense, you know, when I think back about the really scary moments, I think that at times I actually found it exhilarating. I wasn't really scared at all. And that other times, you know, in similar circumstances, I felt absolutely helpless, you know, crippled with fear. So they used to say this about soldiers in the war, that, you know, courage is like a bank account. Sometimes you've got a lot of it and sometimes you haven't.
Yeah, right. And sometimes it can feel quite random, can't it? You can be really brave in something that's objectively more dangerous, and then something that's not quite as dangerous, you're terrified.
And I think, actually, you know, I rate moral courage much more highly than physical courage. You think of those big, tough footballers who run out onto the field, and it doesn't take a lot of courage for a big, tough footballer to tackle another big, tough footballer, you know.
Yeah.
But to take a principled stand that, you know, could perhaps cost them their career, but it's important. That's absolutely something else.
Talking to Chris Masters, Derek texts in, "Bravo, Chris, more power to you." Our text number 0467 922 702. You mentioned before litigation and asking this question. There, you know, I'm aware there are matters being litigated, so you know you can answer in a cautious way if you like. But when you're reporting from war zones, is it hard to judge the truth and the facts of the situation in a war zone that's in a country unfamiliar to you, and where you might being shepherded around, you know, by the armed forces that you're trying to report on?
Well, this is something that I had to think about a lot and confront, because, say, for a lot of the reporting that I did in Afghanistan, as I mentioned before, I was in the company of soldiers who were protecting me. And, you know, you turn up in a village and you ask the Afghans what they think of the Australians, and you've got six beefy soldiers armed to the teeth behind you. You know, they're not necessarily going to tell you what they really think. But look, there's ways of dealing with that. At the end of the day, good journalism is good judgment. And I didn't think that reporting from that perspective was going to be any more problematic than, say, you know, reporting with the Taliban. You know, you really have to work it out for yourself. For some time in Afghanistan, I used to also recruit another crew to work outside the perimeter of the ADF, so that they were picking up intel from the local community. But at the end of the day, all sort of reporting, every reporter confronts the same problem. If you're a sports reporter, you know, the football club is going to try to steer you in their direction.
Yeah.
You've just got to develop good judgment, good skepticism, and I don't think it's nearly as hard as people make out. And I mean, I used to think that if I worked with the ADF, that I'd be heavily censored. To be honest with you, I never really found that at all. I mean, I found that that people were candid, even when I was with Special Forces soldiers. I can remember going off and reporting with them and their Afghan partner force. And there wasn't anybody, there wasn't a media minder behind me, you know. The SAS bloke I was talking to was phenomenally candid, and he told me that he needed to be with these Afghan soldiers, otherwise they were going to kill people, kill non-combatants.
Yep.
I don't look back on it and think that I wasn't able to tell the truth.
Yeah, Rosa says, "Thank you so much, Chris. You sacrificed an awful lot so we could know the truth. Take care." Great to hear you again, Chris. Big congrats on a stellar career. From Linda. Hi, Chris. Thank you for your fearless and determined reporting to help expose corruption at the highest level, Australia and Queensland in particular. And Adrian says, tell him thank you very much. We love his work and how dangerous the profession of journalism is worldwide. Many in Mexico are murdered for it. Chris Masters is my guest. Chris, earlier you were talking about you know, the power of the reputation of the ABC in getting people to trust you and tell the truth to you, and also the fact that often people want to be, as you said, a part of history and tell the truth. Beyond that, do you have any techniques when you're talking to someone to get the answers, to get the most honest answer? And I guess I'm looking at kind of little tactics that you aim to, I guess, put people at ease, or any little things I can use in my next job interview.
I used to sometimes say to people, depending on the story, of course, look, this is for the sake of history. This interview might be watched again in 100 years' time. And I could see the look in their face. You know, they would sit up and they would take notice. It can be wonderful, James, when people decide to be generous and reveal stuff of themselves that maybe, you know, isn't to their favour, but they want to be honest, and that's happened to me. I think that there are times when you look beyond the camera and you see the interviewee and you think, it's like they don't even know a camera is there. I'm not the best interviewer under the sun, and of course I didn't do that adversarial interviewing such as, you know, you were obliged to do on programs like the 7:30 report. But I actually found the opposite. I found that if you weren't adversarial, if you were genuinely curious, you genuinely wanted to know, and I loved every story I did. So that engagement you have with people, I think sometimes they got it and they really wanted to cooperate.
Do you reckon sometimes it's as basic as eye contact? Like if someone's telling you something intimate, you know, I remember having a bit of paper in my hand with questions on it, but just not wanting to look down on it because they're telling me something intimate and I don't want to break, you know, the trust by looking away and reminding them it's an interview.
That's right. One of the first things they taught me when I was working in the bush was don't sit in front of them, sit beside them, treat it like it's a conversation. Mm. And I also noticed that the tone of your voice matters. If you are angry and aggressive, people will be angry and aggressive back at you.
Yeah.
They'll pick up on how you speak. So I often thought that women were better at it than the guys because it was more softly, and people dropped their guard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I, when I was a criminal lawyer, I remember going back and saying to my boss, "Oh, the barrister we had was great. He was shouting and stamping his feet, and oh, it really scared the witness." And my boss just paused and went, "Yeah, well, he's new. He'll learn to stop doing that." And it's a really good illustration that sort of bombast and shouting is not all it's cracked up to me. Do you see any themes that emerge from, you know, a lot of the big stories that you've done? Is it as simple as power corrupts?
I think that the stories you do, they're so different. I don't know that there's a real commonality to it. If there is, it's really in the approach to the story. I think my approach was cab off the rank, a bit like the lawyers. You know, I'll take on the next story that comes my way, whether I want to do it or not, but it will be clear to me that it is the one I should do, which probably means it's one I don't want to do.
Yeah.
And then I will put everything into it, and I will get my breakthroughs if I remain patient. And I don't think we should be snobs about stories. You know, the job is to make what is important interesting rather than the other way around. But every story you do has got something in it. You know, it's really the way you tell it.
Yeah, beautifully put. And more. Text coming in. Someone texts, "Mr. Masters is a moral treasure." Hi, Chris. This is from Emma in Lura. "I spent a year or so on Four Corners as an assistant film editor in 1989-90 and was proud to be a small part of the work that you do. So important. Thanks so much, Chris. I've really appreciated following your stories over the years. You've certainly lived up to your surname." There you go. Someone wants to know if you see anyone who up-and-coming journos that'll take on these type of big stories. And I guess that also opens up the question of how has journalism changed? Four Corners is still doing big stories like this, but is there less of it?
Well, you know, my colleague Nick McKenzie is an absolute phenomenon. You know, I've never seen anybody in Australia as good at investigative journalism and as prolific as he is. So it's still there. You know, the digital age changes things. In some respects, it makes it easier because when it comes to data research, we can be on it so much more quickly. But a problem perhaps is that, you know, it keeps you in the office, and I think that it's still important to get out there. As much as the digital horizon has changed phenomenally, some things never change. The importance of a good story, the things we've been talking about, the importance of a good interview, the importance of a good script, the importance of good editing, and content. You know, you can be really clever and sexy with all of the technology, but if you haven't got the content, what's the point?
Yeah. If there hadn't been any corruption in Queensland, what would have been a pretty boring story?
I'm sure I would have found something. I mean, straight after I did that story, I did a program called The Dead Heart in the Northern Territory about two boys that went missing in the outback. And, you know, look, I could never prove what happened, but it was still worth the ride. And that's important.
Yeah. Look, Chris, thanks so much for joining us. It was a real treat to talk to you on the ABC's 90th birthday and hear all those highlights from your career. But also it's really interesting to get some of the nitty-gritty and the behind-the-scenes stuff about the investigative journalism that you do. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, James.
Yeah, great to talk to you. That's Chris Masters.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.